Hello and welcome to Securities, a newsletter and podcast devoted to science, technology, finance, and the human condition. I'm Danny Crichton, and today we have a special guest, Leslie Schrock, the author of Fertility Rules, the Definitive Guide to Male and Female Reproductive Health. Leslie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me and for doing such a lovely introduction.
Well, thank you. So Leslie, you this is your second book on pregnancy and fertility. The last one was Bumpin'. And I'm curious, like, how did you first get into this whole concept? Because when we think about fertility, it's something that most people want to avoid. No one wants to talk about it. Even our schools don't want to talk about it. And yet every single person is affected by it. So what was your journey into this subject?
I've worked in the digital health space as an investor, advisor, and an entrepreneur for over 10 years. So I was on the founding team at Rock Health. I was a very early advisor to Maven. I'm still an advisor to actually several of the Lux portfolio companies, A-Life, Gamito, and Maven, obviously. And, you know, during that experience, I came up, as so many of us do, assuming that when I was ready to start a family, no problem. It was going to be easy. I was in my mid-30s. I thought, like, yeah, I'm healthy. It's going to be fine. I'll just get pregnant on the timeline that I want. Little did I know I was going to have a very difficult personal journey ahead. So in the end, I had three pregnancy losses. The first was a miscarriage. The second actually ended with a medically necessary abortion, which really was the impetus to me writing my first book. Because what I realized is that, you know, even though I was surrounded by all of the resources and all of these, you know, professional folks in my network who could help me through this, no one had shared that experience with me. I had no one to talk to. And so I felt like miscarriage especially was kind of the gateway for me as an issue that is incredibly common. It happens in as many as one in four pregnancies, we think. And yet no one was really talking about it at the time. So I wrote Bumpin' in real time when I was pregnant with my first son, which was quite an adventure. As you can imagine, Simon & Schuster is still my publisher now. They let me do that, which was kind of crazy. The postpartum section was written postpartum. But in the end, you know, what I realized was that I had gone through, you know, three failed pregnancies. And there was so much that I wish that I had known before I had tried to start a family. And so that was the path that led me to writing Fertility Rules, my now second book, which answers the question, if you're thinking about trying to conceive, what should you know and what should you do? And are fertility cleanses really a thing or not? And the answer is no. There's just so much crap out there, right?
Right. Well, I think a huge part of about the book, so I read the book, and there's two thoughts. First was the number of myths. There's just an incredible amount of misinformation that's out there. A shockingly high number. I mean, we're in a world of COVID misinformation, vaccine misinformation. But what I was surprised by is how little we've actually discussed the fertility misinformation. And the second piece was the amount of planning that goes into here, both on testing, on fertility treatments, on the different options and pathways you can take. Because in my view, it's sort of the textbook seventh grade, which we all sort of got, which was, you know, a banana, a condom, and some
and
gel.
School or something. And it's all awkward.
School nurse. And it's awkward. And that's your only education. And it opened my mind to, you know, there are dozens of tests, there are dozens of procedures, you have dozens of different pregnancy blockage devices or whatever the case may be. How do you sort of grapple with that complexity and those myths today? Because it's gone from something, in my view, so simple to something so complicated.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, one big reason that all of this is more complicated is the average age of first-time parents is creeping up. You know, it used to be mid-20s, then it was the late 20s. Now in coastal cities, it's more like 32 or 33. And the reality is that for men and women, your body just isn't as good at producing sperm and eggs as you age due to, you know, issues during meiosis for women. That's, you know, the process of eggs maturing. And there's nothing you can do about it, like, there's nothing. There's no pill. There's maybe Gamito is going to solve this problem for us. I'm hoping that they do. But the reality is, like, it's not a problem that can just be solved with technology today. You can do assisted reproduction treatments. You can freeze eggs. But there's no guarantee of anything, even when you freeze eggs today. And so I think that really that is what's starting. That is really what's, you know, created the world that we live in today, largely. The other is, you know, the exposure to endocrine disrupting chemicals, which maybe we'll get into a little bit. But, you know, we live in a much more complex world now. We're exposed to a lot. We are, you know, working harder than ever in a lot of ways. We are also more sedentary than ever. And also our food sources. And this is something that was important for me need to dig into in the book, because I think that for most of us, when we engage with the healthcare system, these are not conversations we're having with our doctors. We are not talking to them about our diets. And the truth is, doctors aren't trained in nutrition. They get about 20 hours on average of training during medical school. 4 years, that's it, including fellowships. You know, even if you are undergoing fertility treatments, odds are your doctor is just going to tell you, eat well. But what does that actually mean? And so I think my goal was to wrap, you know, this very basic knowledge that none of us really got as kids, the menstrual cycle, basics of sperm health, hormones, all of it, and really try to kind of reboot the conversation. Because I think it's kind of crazy that men and women don't learn about each other's bodies. Like, why do we have this bifurcated experience as kids where girls are sent off to a room where they're kind of, you know, whispering about right. their periods, and then boys are sent to a room and Lord knows what they're learning. Like, they know, men know even less about their reproductive health than women. Right. It's a travesty. Right. They're not taught as kids. I don't even blame men for the lack of knowledge. Many people do. I don't. I think men want to be better allies. They want to be better partners. They want to be better parents. They simply are never given the information. They do not get it in doctor's appointments. And thus, where are we? And so, you know, I think if we lived in a world where men and women understood fertile windows, for example, the period in which you can actually get a woman pregnant, from the time that they're kids, a lot of the problems we have today would not exist.
When we think about a lot of the myths, to me, there's a huge amount of information that you have in the book that everyone should know. There's information on sperm counts, on general health, the need to use a doctor and a GP effectively. And you have these striking statistics where it's like men don't go to their GPs. They don't get physicals. When they go to the physicals, they don't get checked for any of this sort of stuff. There's almost no sperm testing in general for men as part of a standard practice of care. So you're not looking at sperm motility. You're not looking at the sperm counts. They're only done in sort of academic studies. And that's actually what I thought was interesting is you actually create a system where you're saying, like, look, it's not just about fertility. All this is interconnected with general health. Sperm counts for men and similarly for women, you know, connect into the general wellness. So if you're eating well, if you're working out, if you have a good lifestyle, if you're not sedentary, if you're not drinking or smoking or using cannabis, all these numbers look better, as do almost all the other biomarkers that are at the core of your health. And so you actually position this as not just like if you need children, you should go do these tests, but really this should be part of a general purpose exam that is also informing the rest of your health in general.
Absolutely. I mean, if we could just get guys to do a semen analysis from home, that's such a big step forward in just managing men's health in general, because as you just explained, men are terrible utilizers of the healthcare system. They might control it at the upper levels,
right.
but they certainly don't right. interact with it. You know, how many men do you know who get a yearly physical or even a physical every 2 to 5 years? Not that many. They only interact with the healthcare system when maybe something is about to fall off. And, you know, that's not a great place to be, because it's not just about men's health. So semen parameters are really, they should be considered a biomarker. It is an indicator of a man's overall health. You can tell an awful lot. It can indicate tumors and cancers, all kinds of stuff. If it's not good, odds are something is going on in a man's body. And the good thing for men is that with 3 months plus, you can actually turn semen parameters around. So unlike women who are born with all the eggs they will ever have, men, on the other hand, actually regenerate sperm about every 2 to 3 months. And so if you, for example, stop using cannabis, if you stop using steroids, another one that just came up recently for me, which I was kind of mind blown, is these products that help with hair loss are actually also detrimental to sperm health. So all of these things that we're using to, like, you know, improve men's appearances for aesthetic reasons, actually they should not be using while they're trying to conceive, because it adversely affects your sperm parameters. But the other thing is, and this is, I think what's really resonating with women is that this isn't even just about men's health. This is about future children, and it's about women's health. So unhealthy men create all kinds of problems for women, not just from a caregiving perspective, because, like, let's be honest, we're just going to take care of them in old age too.
Right.
But unhealthy sperm creates unhealthy pregnancies. It increases the risk of gestational diabetes, preeclampsia, preterm birth. It also creates problems for future children. So obese men can pass that on to their kids. Advanced paternal age can drive, neurological conditions. It can drive autism. There are all kinds of interesting links that we're just beginning to understand when it comes to the true effects of the state of a man's body when he conceives. Actually, metformin use is another one that's really, this was a mind-blowing thing. So a researcher out of Stanford that I've gotten to know named Mike Eisenberg, did a study last year about metformin use in men and the fact that men who used it 3 months within trying to conceive a child, those that had a male child were at increased risk of birth defects, genital birth defects. So micropenis, all kinds of stuff, decreased antegenital distance, you know, some things that, you know, as a parent, you definitely would not want to inflict upon your children. My hope is that men hear this.
Right.
And if you're not going to do it for yourself, that's fine. Don't do it for yourself. But if you care about your future children and you want to have healthy future children, perhaps, you know, stopping smoking, THC use, all of the things that we know adversely affect sperm, stop it for your kids.
Right. Well, I think that's the most striking and interesting part of the book, which was obviously fertility is heavily focused on females, but they also have the burden from society, from expectations that, you know, it's the eggs that are a problem. It is women's health that's at risk. You know, you have to eat properly during pregnancy, and if you don't, you're harming your own child. But my striking fact was really what you just described, which was, but all the male components here, I mean, ultimately this baby is coming from two parents, a male and a female combining together through sperm and egg, and that is the ingredients that forms a healthy child. And so if the male is unhealthy, it's just as much of a risk as if the female is unhealthy and vice versa, which I think is a really fundamental fact that did not show up in any part of education and health in clinical practice that I have ever seen.
Yeah, I mean, you would think it's very obvious, right? I mean, it takes, you can't really, we have not figured out how to reproduce without sperm yet.
Right.
So you would think that we would all understand that it's just as important, you know, the state of affairs there as it is with eggs. But I think that because eggs are so scarce and because we know more about their decline because, you know, the advent of egg freezing, you know, we've just simply done more research and because they are scarce, right? Like you can't regenerate your eggs as an adult. You're born with all you're ever going to have. So I think for men, they assume because there's more of it and because they regenerate it all the time and because we hear these news stories of people like Al Pacino and Robert De Niro who have children into their 70s and 80s, that it's just all fine. And sometimes it works out. Sometimes it doesn't. I think another thing that we're, that this is a major hot button issue for me, is ICSI. So intracytoplasmic sperm injection, which is used during IVF cycles to create embryos. And what it is, basically, an andrologist, embryologist, whoever is at that clinic doing that job, chooses, like, looks under the microscope at a sperm sample, semen sample under the microscope, and they choose one sperm based on a visual. So they're using their eyes and a microscope. And as I explain this, you can hear how ludicrous this is, right? They're like, that one looks good. Let's just load that one up in the micropipette and shoot it into the egg. And we're doing this.
Yes.
This technology was developed to treat male factor infertility. This was not developed to use de rigueur in every single IVF cycle. It costs patients out of pocket over $1,000 on average. It's an add-on, but it's now used in over 80%, perhaps as many as 90%. I'm still waiting on this year's figures, actually, from, you know, the clinical data, but it is being used in almost all IVF cycles now, even if the case is not male factor, and it does not increase live birth rates. That's the worst part. It's the only outcome in IVF that matters. You know, people who love ICSI say, well, it increases fertilization rate. That's good. Is making low quality embryos really the goal?
Right.
You might make more of them, but they might not be good.
Right.
So I think it's an example of, you know, how far we have to go in the fertility industry and kind of some of the baseline issues that we have with it as a business.
Well, I want to get to some of the new products here in just a bit. But before we do that, we started off earlier on talking about environmental toxins, which I think is a big part of the fertility conversation today. Sperm counts are down. Eggs are in some case weakened over time from different environmental factors. And we're just starting to learn all the different factors that go into this, everything from microplastics and parabens and a whole list, and you have a whole table of potential threats that makes me want to...
Many pages.
I love this comment of, like, the burrito is more dangerous than the hamburger, which is actually somehow cheese pizza is the best thing you could possibly eat, which I'm totally fine with, by the way. I think that's a great policy, just cheese pizza all the time. But let's talk a little bit about the environmental toxins, because that is also a trigger in addition to age, and the age at which people are trying to conceive is this sort of increase ambiently in our environments of these toxins?
So there was a very famous study that was published in 2017 about the temporal trends in sperm. So, and it indicated that in the last 50 years, sperm counts have gone down. It was just updated in November of last year. And because the big nit people had with this study was that it was not reflective of global data. It is reflective now, and it shows there is a decline globally. And the leading suspected cause is BPAs and phthalates, which are found in mostly in foods, plastics, all of the things that we have developed in the past 50 years. Funny timing with the study. And, you know, we're exposed to constantly. You know, one thing a lot of people don't know is, like, even the ink on receipts, that stays on your skin. That can stay on your skin for weeks. Being exposed to that, I'm like a tin hat person with receipts now. I just, like, don't even want to I don't even want to touch them, you know.
I'll fight our expense policy on that one.
Digital only, please.
Right, exactly.
You know, but, you know, we're exposed to microplastics in the foods that we eat, the way that foods are packaged, takeout, all of these things. The coating on the inside of takeout containers actually, you know, transmits all kinds of weird plastics into the food. You know, so a couple tips that I have for people generally are, when it comes to your food at home, try to eat whole foods, organic foods as often as you can. Store your foods in plastic, or sorry, store it in glass, and don't microwave plastic. Those are some easy ways to do it, because, you know, we're never going to avoid all of it. There is no possible way, unless you live in a cave and don a tin hat, and maybe that's your vibe.
Right.
But you're not really going to have a real existence that way. And so I think that it's important to know what the worst things are. And that's really what I tried to do with that table. There's a similar table actually in my first book with Bumpin' that has to do with, you know, the worst offenders in terms of, like, the things we know cause birth defects and, you know, big problems in pregnancy, like retinols and salicylic acid and some other, you know, things that are found in skincare products mostly. But it is very disturbing, as someone who's been reading and researching this and talking to experts, you know, from all walks of clinical practice, researchers, you know, many, many people, and everyone agrees that the world we live in today is just not very well suited for fertility. You know, we were talking about climate change a little bit. I think that that's another, you know, the rise in heat. Not good for sperm. Sperm doesn't like heat. That's, like, the whole problem with external genitalia, I suppose. It's, you know, very susceptible to changes in temperature. Sperm counts go down, the more heat goes up. So I think it's a problem. Women, you know, we haven't shown the same impact on eggs yet, but who knows? We don't know. The research hasn't been done, so we just don't even know. Wildfires is another thing. You know, studies done on firefighters showing the exposure to, you know, all of the smoke and particulate matter and everything else. Male firefighters utilize IVF, I think, something like 10x the rate of a normal person.
Yeah.
And the miscarriage rate in female firefighters is very, very high. So we know that in that population, if you're using them as the canary in the coal mine, nothing good is happening.
Well, and that's a huge theory. You know, we call this podcast securities, but it's this intersection of health security, economic security, social security, national security, all those complicated, intertwined pieces. And to me, like, this is a great example, right? We have climate change. It's increasing the heat around the world. That's lowering sperm counts in and of itself. And I think your statistic was that over the temperature of 80, sperm counts go down quite significantly at that temperature. So basically just a little bit above room temperature. So just being out in the summer heat. But on top of that, because of wildfires, we have all this particulate mass coming into the air, just like in New York City, just 2 weeks ago as we're recording, all these Canadian wildfires coming in from Quebec, blanketing the city with smoke and particulate mass. I have an actual air pollution monitor in my home, and, you know, it's like sealed and it was okay for a couple hours, but you guys start to see a tick up as the air was transmitted from inside the house to outside, that we were starting to actually breathe really dangerous air. And that has deep repercussions going in throughout our reproductive systems and bodies, which is a whole other area even beyond just lung health, which I think is how that usually gets positioned. It's like, well, you can't breathe as well, but everything else will be fine. It's actually, there's long-term effects. And once you've had them, in some cases, they're permanent.
Yes. Well, and I mean, fertility is one thing, but pregnant women, heat is already a problem because your body is doing some hard work. It's like running a marathon every day being pregnant. And, you know, that has impacts on future children, too. Exposure to poor quality air can impact a pregnancy. It can impact what happens during that pregnancy, the development of a fetus. And so I think we all need to pay attention. You know, it's difficult to give this advice because most people don't have the option. But if you do live in a wildfire, you know, an area that's particularly fraught with wildfires, you know, you definitely need to keep some N95s around.
Right.
And if you can leave during a pregnancy or spend time somewhere with clean air, but again, like most of the world does not have that option.
Right.
You know,
air filters are expensive. Air conditioners are expensive.
But it's what all the professional organizations say. And even though it doesn't
really,
it's like, well, how many people can actually do that, though? Can we can we talk about other ways to solve this problem that don't involve physically moving?
Well, and what was funny was, you know, they said the same thing with New York. And I was talking to my husband and I was like, well, should we go? Because I'm looking at the air is getting worse and worse and we're inside. Carbon monoxide's going up. I'm like, we can't breathe. And then we started to look like, where can we go? And you couldn't go anywhere because it blanketed the entire eastern United States. They couldn't take off flights from LaGuardia and JFK. And so the idea that you can just escape, that there's some sort of red button that's like, okay, get me out of here, everything will be okay, is sort of a mirage. In many cases, you can't. And particularly when we're talking about environmental toxins, as you point out in the book, thanks to plastics in the ocean, fish are detected. Well, like something about 80, 90% of all fish have plastics in them.
Yeah.
And that's leading to effects all throughout the animal kingdom. So I think you mentioned that dogs, their sperm counts have declined in and of themselves. So it's like, even though you're not hopefully serving the dog from the takeout container that was microwaved from the Chinese restaurant, they're still being affected as well. It's just ambient in the environment. But I want to pivot the conversation to the last component here, which is about all the different products and science and technologies that have come out in this industry. Because, you know, I think 20 years ago, you had a couple of different options for preventing pregnancy. You had a couple of tests. You had a couple of techniques in the office, so to speak, to evaluate sort of fertility health. But this has exploded in the last 20 years. You have a dozen plus, period tracking apps. You have a dozen plus tests for both men and women and around fertility and figuring out their health. And then obviously, as you get into pregnancy, there's just more and more options you can do. And then outside of this whole thing, you have egg freezing and all these other sections, and you have a whole nother chapter on this. And so I'm curious, because you're both an investor, you're in this, but you've also been a patient and someone who's used all these different, or at least some of these different techniques and tools. What's exciting and interesting and on the frontier here today? What needs to get more into the mainstream? What are people missing? Because in my view, there's sort of that William Gibson quote of like, the future's already here, it's just not equally distributed. And my view from fertility is like, we have a lot of things we're just not using that are on the shelf.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very excited about companies like Alife, for example, that is really applying the promise of AI and machine learning to IVF. There are so many ways that process could be better. Right now, it's changed some since its origins back in the late 70s when Louise Brown was born in the UK, the first IVF baby. But it hasn't changed enough. You know, we're still kind of sending patients off with some shots and some basic timing and saying good luck. There are a lot of nuances to, you know, timing shots, all of the things related to that. So, you know, embryo selection is another one. But there's a lot we can learn from huge data sets. So I'm excited about what they're doing. I think also some of these treatments are overused. I talked about ICSI a little bit earlier. I think that for every technology that is developed, we need to really ask ourselves, is this making the world better for everyone if it is applied? Or is this just something that's going to give people the sense of control? That's a common thing that doctors and patients will say when it comes to ICSI as an example, is that, well, it may not, you know, increase the live birth rate, but it gives the perception of control. And the perception of control when you're undergoing infertility treatments or even struggling with a fertility journey is kind of everything, because you feel so helpless. You feel like you can't do anything about it. There's nothing you can do to make this better. And I think that is why so much about the business, could be better, because I think there's a lot being, you know, that happens in a clinic that probably shouldn't, because patients don't know, and it's a cash pay business for the most part. Fertility benefits, are great. They're not available to everybody. Insurance doesn't cover it. There are some states that have insurance mandates, but not everywhere. But I think we have a long way to go on that side. I'm also, you know, Gamito, I'm very excited about, you know, the prospect of being able to age immature eggs outside of the body, you know, which hopefully will not undergo all of those meiotic errors during the maturation process if it's, you know, not susceptible to the issues in the human body. So that's a thing I get excited about. And then, you know, I think that we all need to just step back and think about whether or not we want to live in a world where we are so reliant on all of this, when there are so many things that you can do to try to put your best foot forward before you go to IVF. So no one should just jump into IVF unless you have a genetic condition that you're going to pass down or there's a well-established reason to do it. Most of the time, there should be a more incremental approach. And so I'm excited by some of the companies that are, you know, launching for ICI, that's intracervical insemination. It's basically the turkey baster method. There are now FDA cleared. Frida just came out with an at home, you know, turkey baster method, which is really kind of phenomenal because it actually has the same efficacy rate as IUI, which you would then go do in the doctor's office. IUI is over 6 times the cost, same effectiveness. So how do we ask ourselves, what can you do earlier? What can you do when you're first thinking about trying to conceive in terms of lifestyle improvements, in terms of really kind of taking a hard look at where you're at, assessing your medications, assessing, you know, what your exposures are, doing everything you can ahead of it? Because like I said, you know, cannabis use, steroids, which men lie about in appointments, by the way, know, even when they're told that it has adverse effects on their sperm production, and then like men's hair loss medication, like all of these things that men just are never told. They don't come with reproductive health warnings. So what can we do before we ever have to rely on all of this technology to just improve our overall lifestyles?
Well, I think one of the big things that comes out of that whole theme, and it really is sort of the spine of the book, if you will, from a thesis perspective, is this lack of information and the need to fill in gaps, which is, you know, 1985, you had Courtney Cox going on to an advertisement on television, and it was the first time the word period, at least in the context of women's health, was ever mentioned on American television in the mid-80s, which both makes sense and is also like depressing, but also like, oh, I could see how that would happen in that period of time. And I just made a period joke right there. but I think the other side of this is, as we get into a lot of the apps, period tracking, when you talk about A-Life with AIML, what we're seeing is we're actually collecting data from millions of people simultaneously. And that actually allows us to create best practices and actually disseminate the ways that these things work. So when you start talking about ICI versus, I think it was like IUI, you know, you can start to do the comparative effectiveness research. Whereas today, when no one talks about it, no one's actually willing to tell their doctor what's happening, when everyone's sort of siloed, we can't share what actually works. And that oftentimes means we lead to the technology first, because that's America. We like to just start with our gadgets and gizmos, as opposed to saying, like, look, let's talk about it in a group. And because I've now learned that there are better ways to go about it, I feel better. I now know what the best strategies are. I can use the fertility window properly. And if that doesn't work, these technologies are a great backup. But let's do the easy stuff up front. I want to stop here, or finish with one final question, though, which is, you had a long journey, obviously, in fertility, in pregnancy. Obviously, a lot of folks are suffering in the same way. That's why the book has been successful. That's why you've written two of them. How do you deal with the anxiety pieces to it? Because I think you've addressed a little bit of the sort of mental health component, both in terms of people's fears that they're infertile and they're not going to be able to have a pregnancy, as well as that sort of waiting period where you've copulated and now you're in this waiting zone. I think you call it the TTW.
The two-week window.
The two-week window, TWW.
Two-week wait, rather.
Two-week wait. The TWW of sort of this, what they now call like screening anxiety in medical terms. How do you deal with the mental health aspects of pregnancy on that side?
I think knowledge is a big part of it. Knowing that miscarriage has always been a part of pregnancy, and that if it happens to you, you're in the company of many, I think makes it more normal. It makes it feel, I mean, it is truly a part of the process for so many people. It's been happening for a very long time, as long as humans have been here. So I think knowledge is such a big part of it. But I think the other, you know, the other thing that just has to change is just education. We just have to teach people how to take care of themselves. We have to teach them, you know, from a young age that periods are not shameful. Periods are not something that are gross. We have to teach boys, like, this is the period of time when you can get right. a girl pregnant. It's not during their period, you know, I can't tell you. And we have to teach girls how to, you know, track ovulation. And I think mm-hmm. something that's very tangibly different in recent years is that, you know, conditions like PCOS mm-hmm. can make you know, cervical mucus monitoring, for example, which is you assess the viscosity of your cervical mucus. That doesn't work for people with PCOS because it changes the quality of your cervical mucus. So you have mm-hmm. no clue based on that. Basal body temperature. You may or may not have any indication. Did you sleep well? Did you, you know, drink the night before? Did you get out of bed and then get back in bed? Like, that all changes, you know, that temperature spike and your ability to interpret it. So I'm also kind of excited about some of the next gen fertility tracking devices mm-hmm, that, mm-hmm. you know, maybe you pee on a stick and it gives you a lot of information. The fact that they now contain, you know, progesterone test strips, which is the only way to tell if you actually did ovulate it. Mm-hmm, you know, most mm-hmm. of the things you buy at the, you know, pharmacy currently just tell you about your LH surge. And mm-hmm. that indicates mm-hmm. you're about to ovulate. Progesterone is the only thing that tells you if you actually did. So I do think that there are, you know, other things that are really helping people
yep.
at home tell, you know, whether or not they're on the right track.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, Leslie, thank you so much for joining us. Leslie Schrock, the author of Fertility Rules and Bumpin', mm-hmm. second book, congratulations. Grab it at bookstores everywhere.
Thanks.
Thank you, Leslie.